All right, let's strap in. Got nowhere to go. Got nothing to do. Let's do some radio every day for 3 hours. I'm back after my little mini vacation. Took Thursday, Friday off last week. Played golf on Friday. Little did I know, my final golfing round in who knows how long. Luckily for me, back nine, finally figured it out. Part 18. So I'm ready to go. Whenever golf resumes, I'll be right there, ready to go, feeling good. How you feeling?
Upset. Very upset. I have to take vacation days.
Yeah.
I have to.
Right.
I have some that are from last year that I really need to take. And what am I supposed to do? I'm going to take time off so I can listen to you do the show?
Oh, I have a suggestion. And we did this yesterday, but who knows? I might have been breaking the rules. I didn't see this one written down explicitly that you couldn't do it. But you tell me. Dougie, if you're listening, give me a shout on Twitter. If I'm breaking any rules by doing this thing called geocaching. My wife has this app. Have you heard of this thing?
Well, yeah, because you've told me about it.
Yeah, there's people that hide little treasures around in the woods, and you go search for those. So I climbed a tree yesterday to find a geocache. Maybe that's for you.
Yeah, that sounds against the rules. That sounds against the rules.
It sounds way more dangerous than playing frisbee golf, that's for sure.
I did that on Friday. Drove out to past Hamilton to play, actually, at this beautiful, beautiful, beautiful course in the middle of nowhere where there was no people. We're in a massive park.
Not bad. You're bad.
Massive park.
Bad boy.
Saw a father with two sons playing who were both way better than myself and Sam. Undeniably way better. It felt embarrassed, actually, having seen them play. Saw an elderly couple walking through the park, and then saw one guy throwing discs and practicing. God forbid, though. God forbid you move around on a beautiful day and walk through a park and be with a friend. Because, as we know, all the news stories, I would just like to formally apologize for all the people who have walked in the park that you keep hearing about on the news.
Right.
Spreading COVID-19.
Yep. So I don't want to do too much on this because honestly it's too frustrating and I'll just end up punching my computer.
Well, this is they used to do the Jalen Rose don't get fired. Mm-hmm. And this next 10 minutes is don't get fired, basically.
Well, yeah. And I was talking to my dad blowing off some steam yesterday and he's like, "You know, I don't know if what you can say that." That's and I was, okay, whatever. I shouldn't have talked to him. But there's so many layers of frustration for me. But I think it starts with this, that there is this sense from the government, the provincial government, the idea brought down to the populace is that it's your fault. Mm-hmm. You've done something wrong.
Right.
This is on you. What you've done hasn't been good enough. You haven't been paying attention. You haven't been following the rules. You've been gathering in groups indoors, and you're the reason why we're worse off than we ever have been in a year and a half of this COVID-19. When, in fact, the reality is we've been let down by our politicians from day one of this thing. And it is not people even getting together on patios back in the, like, long before times when restaurant outdoor eating was available, and it's certainly not from people playing golf or going out in the park and playing frisbee golf. It's from people indoors, essential workers in close proximity with poor ventilation, and it's time and time again, and anyone who has an MD or has looked into the numbers behind any of these outbreaks will tell you exactly the same thing. In fact, we're going to have one on during the 11 o'clock hour. That's the most frustrating part. You did nothing wrong. If you can hear me and your name is not Doug Ford and you don't work for Doug Ford, you did nothing wrong.
It's beyond frustrating to me. It's sickening. It's irresponsible. It's negligent. And it's going to have ripple effects that last for our lifetimes, which is devastating. I'm just going to speak for myself. Friday night, I think a lot of people went through the same thing, which was, what are you supposed to do? How are you supposed to feel? A lot of people were scared. A lot of people were upset. I imagine that a lot of people were depressed. One of the only things we've had throughout this is the ability to be outside and feel as though we still live in a free country where everyone has sacrificed so much, and everyone has.
Yep.
And you and I have done this from the very beginning, that there is a culture of shame, there is a culture of finger pointing and blame and anger that is frankly incorrect. Almost everyone is doing their best. There are a few people that are going to pop up in the news, and there are a few people that are going to absorb a lot of headlines for being anti-vax, anti-mask, whatever, whatever, whatever. The vast majority of people care. They have proven over and over and over again that we care about our healthcare system, that we care about our frontline workers, that we care about our doctors and nurses, and that we care about our most vulnerable in this population. It's why we have gone through this. So to have that happen, to have that blame shift back to the populace, and to remove the few activities that we have to keep us sane, to keep us active, to keep us healthy, to discourage that to the point where they would enforce a police state, and don't get it twisted, that is exactly what this is abhorrent. It's inexcusable. It's disgusting. This is a sports show, and so I'll just keep it to the sports angle of this, which is people are going to cry and say, some people, and I don't even mean to strawman this, but some people will say, it's just a few weeks without golf. Hey, Bunk, it's just a few weeks where you can't go walk in the park and throw a disc. Hey, it's just a few weeks where, you know, maybe don't go walk with a friend. No, those things are very, very important. Those are the few things that we had left. And throughout all of this, we have had so many people say mental health matters and physical health matters. In fact, if you look at a lot of the people that end up getting put on vents, a lot of the people that end up getting put in the ICU, it's because their bodies are not very healthy. So to discourage activity, to discourage being outdoors, to discourage movement and ways to get the endorphins flowing, get your blood flowing, get your heart rate up, be active, feel a sense of purpose, feel a sense of accomplishment. I'm at a loss. I'm genuinely at a loss. And we have done this whole thing, right, where we've watched sports advocate for things like Black Lives Matter and trying to understand that minority populations get hit with this differently. And here we are today with different policing policies that are obviously going to be more heavily enforced to minority communities, that are obviously going to hit poor communities even harder. So all of these things that we thought that we were going to learn, trust the science, be aware of the different ways that policing affects minority groups, being aware of your health and your mental health, all of these things that have become forefront for us as citizens over the last year, right? That life is precious, that you need to be outdoors a little bit more, that you need to connect a little bit more, that community matters. All of this has been stricken by this completely incompetent government. And it's brutal. It's unbelievably brutal. And yeah, it makes it really, really hard to do a sports radio show today. It made it really, really hard to watch sports over the weekend.
Yep.
It made it hard to focus on anything other than being upset. So
yep.
I'm sorry to anyone who's pissed that we haven't already been talking about the Leafs, but this is front of mind and this is what is important today. And so, yeah, we're going to have on a couple of people today that are going to help us basically talk through this and try to reason with us and hopefully steer us back towards a place where we can just be sane again.
There are well-meaning people, a lot of well-meaning people, who have done their best to abide by the rules and listen to the government, even if they had questions about what exactly the plan was. But, you know, follow along. Don't make waves. Their trust has been completely eroded, and deservedly so. There is no reason to believe anything that this provincial government is telling you. And I don't think it's something nefarious coming down from the people in charge here that want to feel like they're in control and powerful. I think it's just pure incompetence. I think it's gone so pear-shaped for them that they don't know what to do, that they're doing anything. And optically, if we just shut everything down, That's got to do something, right? No, what does something is giving people paid sick leave, alleviating the problem in cramped and poorly ventilated essential workplaces, not stopping people from going golfing, for God's sakes. Anyways, let's talk about the fun stuff, the sports.
No, I would have said the Blue Jays wasted my afternoon yesterday, but I was not allowed to do anything else. So I watched what was, I think, the worst pitched game with limited runs that I've ever seen. That it was hilarious listening to Tabby and Shulman say, "Is it a pitcher's duel yet?" And I was screaming at my TV. No, it's not.
0-0 can be a pitcher's duel. Usually is. I would say you got a 95% chance of watching a pitcher's duel scoreless through five innings. That was anything but. And in fact, if aliens landed and they asked you, "Hey, what's a sport that you like? What's a thing that you use in your spare time to entertain yourself?" And you're like, "Baseball." And it's like, "Oh, let's see a few innings." And you showed them that, they'd be like, "Okay, there's something wrong with the population of this planet.
This planet has nothing entertaining."
It's awful. Robbie Ray hasn't been fixed. Hey, you take what he gave you, usually, like 9 times out of 10, 5 scoreless. So, hey, process results. Give me those results, I suppose. But it was heinous, 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 heinous. Blue Jays offense has been heinous. And it's better than this, and hopefully it's going to get a lot better than this really soon, because George Springer apparently nearing a return, not for the Red Sox series, maybe against the Rays, though, after that. They're hitting, I think, collectively under 240 as a group, just in an overall sense. Hitting with runners in scoring position, though, has been abominable.
They had two bats in the lineup yesterday.
Yeah.
And it felt like if they got through Vlad and Bo, it was just woof. Eh.
Kirk is coming around, but yeah, I'm with you.
Sure.
They had two singles in the game, so hard for me to argue.
I know
with that.
Brady Singer had his good stuff, but yeah, there's a lot of hopeless ABs in there.
Yeah, they're now 25 for 130 with runners in scoring position. Another 0 for 5 day yesterday. That's under 200. So not only are they better than the 240 collective batting average they've had this season, even if they were that bad offensively, we're a 240 hitting club, eventually the runners with scoring position averages are going to be at 240. Listen, I'm a guy that clutch is sometimes real. It's not this real, okay? They've run into some bad luck. The pitching has been way better than expected, but the offense has been awful, awful.
So, two things. One, will there be a 30 for 30 short on the TJ Zoik start, where he got through four innings of clean baseball against the New York Yankees? That?
Well, it helps that the Yankees stink, apparently. So yeah.
Yeah, the Yankees are what, 5-10?
Yes.
Yeah, they're doing quite poorly. Two is, do you subscribe to the theory that, because this is a theory among baseball fans, and I know that we're always about things regulating, right? It's we talk about it with sports, with shooting percentages, and blah blah blah. Mm-hmm. When you're a team that leaves runners on base frequently early and you don't cash early, that it's something that lingers throughout your season. That it's something teams – it's part of an identity of a team. Because I have a little bit of that inside where I look at this Jays team and I say there's not a lot of dudes who get on base and there's still big potential for massive innings where guys hit home runs when you do get a couple on. But – I still look at this lineup right now and say, if they don't get George Springer back in there, it just, the rest of the lineup doesn't make sense because Semien at the top is not working. In fact, I'm not really sure where Semien in your lineup works. Like 8? Okay, that's fine. They clearly need Teoscar Hernandez. I don't know why Lourdes Gurriel Jr. is getting off days when they don't have 4 major league bats in the lineup, but whatever. That's a different conversation, I guess. But, yeah, just too many swing and miss guys still. Too many swing and miss guys. It's just, I keep coming back to the same thing, and I know it's annoying, but, God, this team just needed Michael Brantley. Michael Brantley was so critically important for them. And everyone keeps saying that Semien's a better fit because he can play defense. I just don't see it. I don't see him being a better fit. I just don't. Because the whole thing is supposed to be about offense, and he completely changes the way that you look at this offense.
He is, I know he's been basically a leadoff hitter his entire career. He's a what's his career on base? 321. 321 career on base percentage, which is, I think, actually in this day and age, slightly above average. That's bad. That's not what you want from your leadoff hitter. That's bad, and he's well below that now, and he's
hit a couple
home runs. But
he's not the leadoff hitter. He'd be the two-hole.
Yeah, I don't necessarily like Marcus Semien hitting in the top half of this order, and I certainly don't like him leading off. But then you look around the lineup, and you're like, well, who should it be? Especially with Kevin Biggio not in there. And Kevin Biggio, I still believe, is a major league bat, especially with the on-base. He's not an above-average or well-above-average major league bat, but he's a major league bat, in my opinion. He's going through a little bit of a slump and gives you something that you sorely need in this lineup that's so right-handed heavy and doesn't have a bunch of walk guys. He can do both of those things. Mm-hmm. But I will say it was also pretty... I almost got the bends going through the Kevin Biggio defense at third base experience, and then a couple of games where you get above average defense from Santiago Espinal and even Joe Panik at that position.
Yeah.
Because there is defense matters, and we've talked about it ad nauseum and how much that sunk this Blue Jays team at times a season ago. And if Kevin Biggio is not giving you the offense that you hope to get from him and expect to get from him, getting zero defense can be a killer, and there's been multiple games this season where defenses sunk this team.
Yeah, I'm with you. I like Biggio. I think you're right. He's in a slump. But part of the Kevin Biggio story, anyways, is that he was exceeding expectations for the first couple of years, while Vlad was missing them by such a wide margin that we started to have the conversation of, are these guys on the same planet when it comes to importance in the team? And I think it sort of miscast Cavan a little. You know,
yeah,
with the way that we looked at them as the three, when really it's the two, and Kevin Biggio is simply not a part of that. And it's a difficult, when you're talking about the bends, I do think that there's a difficult part of watching him play and having expectations way too high. And then you compound in putting him at a position that, frankly, he has not shown one sign of being able to play. And it's that makes for quite a difficult start.
Yeah. Again, I still like him. I don't think he's going to be a perennial all-star, but you're right. The expectations levied to him, who was once thought to be an organizational guy, like a guy that will never factor into your major league plans, has turned himself into a viable major leaguer, and I still believe that. There were times last year where I thought he was the most reliable Blue Jays at bat, and he will still give you a reliable at bat. He's hitting well below the Mendoza line. His on-base percentage is almost 300. Like, it's higher than Marcus Semien's, even still, with this abominable start. But when you're not hitting, you got to play at least average defense, and they haven't got it at that position. Are you ready to now admit that Alejandro Kirk is this team's number one catcher?
I've always thought Alejandro Kirk is this team's number one catcher.
Oh, have you? Oh, have you?
I didn't think that the organization would move this quickly off of him, onto him being the number one catcher. But I don't know what your option is when, again, you're missing this much offense. This is the position the Blue Jays are in. It's... We've always said, survive the start. When we did our season power line ratings, we said, this is one of the biggest stories. They have to survive this start. So far, decent. I would say that they've left some wins on the table. They've beaten the Yankees, but again, the Yankees have gotten off to such a slow and bad start that you actually don't even look at those wins the same way, right? They're 5-10, and they haven't been able to cobble together a start from a pitcher that isn't named Gerrit Cole. Survive the start. No one thought the start was going to even be this bad. We thought the start was going to be brutal because of the starting pitching they've gotten. So far, that's been all right. But now they're entering a point where you've lost guys like Ross Stripling, and you already had to remove Tanner Roark, and you've lost some bullpen arms. And you told me yesterday that the Romano thing, despite how scary it sounded, it seems to be not so bad.
Don't say ulnar neuritis when the guy's only going to miss the minimum 10 days on the injured list and he's totally fine. Don't tell us it's ulnar neuritis. Yeah. Say he's feeling a little stiff. He'll be back soon. Don't even put the medical jargon into our brains.
Yeah, thank you. You're right. That's a very good take. Don't do that. Just do upper body, just like in hockey. Just do upper body 10 days, okay? That's fine. We can live with that at the beginning of the season. The bullpen is... in such a bad place that so like even as Robbie Ray was getting guys out yesterday or getting out of jams, you were frustrated because you knew there was nothing back there. You knew that eventually it was going to lead to exactly what happened, which is as soon as they go to this bullpen, they're going to have to throw a Tanner Roark or a Zoik out there. And, hey, there's a reason why they're not drafting pitch-to-contact players anymore, or that that's not really a thing that you hear anymore, that it's, hey, we should get pitch-to-contact. No, that's why the Blue Jays like to go after swing-and-miss guys. That's their whole organizational philosophy for a reason, and it's the one that's prevalent throughout baseball for a reason, because those guys give up leads. They give up runs. Contact leads to runs. The offense doesn't look at all prepared to carry the load that it needs to because they're not healthy. I just, when we, again, going back to Survive the Start, how is this team supposed to cobble together wins until the bats get healthy and or until they get some arms back here? Because I don't see the formula for how they win baseball games outside of, frankly, a lot of luck.
Well, they have, Mike Trout had a good run as the best hitter in baseball. It's now Vlad Jr.'s world.
Well, yeah, so. He's brilliant, and... Yeah, the highlights of my day are watching Vlad Jr. ABs. It's so phenomenal getting chances to just watch this guy play and feeling how different it is this season from last, where it just felt like he was grounding out sharply to the third baseman over and over and over again, to now where it's different parts. Just everything is beautiful about this man now. He just has the patience at the plate, the power showing up. The swagger, all those sunglasses. I want those sunglasses that he was wearing so badly yesterday, those cool orange Nike sunglasses. He's just the coolest guy. That's the thing. Everything is just falling into place for Vlad Jr. I really do believe that if you had to say a season, at the end of this season, name the five most recognizable players in baseball, that he will be among them. I just don't know how that's not going to happen.
No, it's happening right now. I mean, I pay too close attention to baseball Twitter, but you cannot go a day without baseball Twitter popping off on Vlad Jr. and what.
But there's zero to critique right now. He looks great. He looks powerful. He looks athletic. He's playing good defense at his position.
Yep,
everything has been great. If you go and look at the Blue Jays season, it's been Vladimir Guerrero Jr. A+++++, all of the pluses. Then I would say a drop off to Bo, because Bo's defense has still been an issue, and
he's been pretty bo-ish at the plate.
Everybody else, I would say, is not meeting the criteria of what you want, right?
No.
Other than Mats. I would say Mats is also A++.
Yeah. I mean, I don't want to do too much on Steven Matz, but Steven Matz is already.
Why not?
I don't know, because it feels like we're talking about the offense here. But yeah, Steven Matz is already everything you could have possibly hoped for and more. Even if he pumpkinifies slightly, I mean, there's process results there with Steven Matz. Like, he's throwing 97, he's painting corners. There's nothing to scratch your head about when it comes to Steven Matz, because he's been this before.
Yeah. Okay, so we got to pump the brakes and we got to get back to the main thing, though, because this kind of happens when we have a weekend of Blue Jay stuff to go over and they lose a couple of games and they have that horrible game, which is we end up talking about a million different things and blah, blah, blah. But the reason we talked about all these million things is that it gets back to the core point, which is what I want to ask you. How is this team going to cobble together wins right now? Because I think the American League is actually a little bit better than we thought. And I know what you're going to say, but
you do.
All of a sudden, they're back to being my Mariners. They smoked Houston yesterday, 7-2. The Mariners are just getting that early season classic. They go on a run, get me to bite and pay attention to the team, and then as soon as I do, they are going to just completely tank it and get killed. This is just year over year over year, the Mariners' hope of them getting into the playoffs. But you look around, the Red Sox, I haven't had a lot of an opportunity to watch. But
offense
I've
good.
The offense is good, man. The offense is good, and they have better pitching, and they're going to get Chris Sale back. There's a real chance for them to be somebody. The Yankees, I believe, are going to go on a run at some point here. And if the Red Sox and Yankees are both good, we know Tampa Bay is going to be competent. Maybe this division is not going to be as easy as we thought, where it was, hey, it's a layup that it's the Jays and the Yankees. Well, as of today, those two teams are sitting at the very bottom with the Orioles.
Well, I don't know if anyone was ever saying it was a layup, but I do think, yeah, the Red Sox are...
We did a lot of bringing on Yankees people, and I had Don LaGreca on Friday saying, or Thursday, going, oh, man, imagine being a Yankees fan for the next 5 years. You got to eat it. You got to watch Bo. You got to watch Vlad kill your team. And he's like, yep, no, it's the Jays. They're right there. The Jays are ready. They're prime. So, yeah, things change pretty quickly. This show is very much living in the moment right now. But, yeah, how are they going to win, Benny? How are they going to win? Just Vlad ABs? Vlad's going to carry a baseball team? Because Mike Trout doesn't carry a baseball team to playoffs.
So you kind of laid it out, in fact. You said that the offense is abominable right now.
Mm-hmm.
I said the offense is abominable. It's not this bad. Okay, so multiple things. One, Teoscar Hernandez is going to return. And very soon. This is a guy that was hitting fourth ahead of Vlad Jr. at the start of the season. He's been out with the COVID contact tracing.
Yeah, symptomatic.
He tested positive.
Yeah.
So he's going to return very soon. Lourdes Gurriel not in the lineup, and you wondered about that. But the Yankees played the rubber match of their three-game series against the Blue Jays without DJ LeMahieu and Giancarlo Stanton.
Care what other teams do. This is just stupid, though.
That's baseball.
You can't have Josh Palacios and Joe Panik in your lineup and Jonathan Davis, and expect them there yesterday. Right. What are we doing here? Just put Lourdes Gurriel Jr. in there and say that sometimes you can't get rest days when other guys are hurt and you're missing them. When George Springer comes back, you can give Lourdes Gurriel Jr. a couple of days off in a row. It's fine. I don't want to get into the sports science thing too much here, but Lourdes Gurriel Jr. can't have a day where he plays left field. Guess what? What was going to happen? He's going to break his foot jogging to a baseball?
I mean, if that was going to happen, it's going to happen either way. Also, I don't know if you've seen the schedule. They're not playing today. And they're not playing Thursday.
I know.
They have two off days this week. And then guess what? Next week, they're not playing on Monday. They're not playing on Thursday next week.
Yeah.
So, yeah, there's more than enough off days now. You just went through a string of 16 games in 16 days, despite the fact that you actually had two rainouts in there. So not really. But, I'm with you. But this is the way baseball is. And I can only be angry at one thing at a time.
What are you angry at? Oh, the state of
the other thing that we that we did 15 minutes on off the top of the show.
No.
So yeah, I don't have the energy to be that angry at that. How is this team going to win games? By being naturally better offensively, by getting some healthy bats back. But even the bats that are in there are going to be better. We've seen it. Alejandro Kirk is starting to realize his offensive potential. Randall Grichuk is normalizing in a negative way. I do think Marcus Semien is better than this offensively. I think Lourdes Gurriel was actually starting to get back to his Lourdes Gurriel self before he was summarily removed from the lineup. Rowdy Tellez actually has put together some half-decent at-bats recently. Kevin Biggio, same thing. So the offense is going to be naturally better. Hyunjin Ryu is still Hyunjin Ryu. Steven Matz is a real thing now that you can almost count on every fifth day to keep you in a ball game. Robbie Ray is exactly what we thought, which is a middle-of-the-rotation guy who's going to take a million pitches to get through a game because he's going to walk everybody. Mm-hmm. And then outside of that, okay, it's some Jetsam and Floatsam, Anthony Kays, and maybe another TJ Zoik. Tanner Roark maybe gets another kick at the can, but all of a sudden, Nate Pearson's throwing live batting practice. The starting pitching is going to get better. The bullpen, even missing as many pieces as they have, has been one of the absolute bright spots. Jordan Romano and his ulnar neuritis is going to return as soon as he's eligible to come off the injured list. Tyler Chatwood, he's coming back as well. There's a lot of good things about this team. Plus, talking about the Bens, they're 7-9. They were 7-9 a season ago. They lost the next two games to go 7-11, and they finished above 500, right? We have to recalibrate a 162-game season. It felt so important last year in a 60-game season, and they were able to rebound. Yankees are 5-10. 97, the Yankees went 5-10, won 96 games. So, yeah, I know it sucks to say or to hear someone say it's early, but it is early also.
Yeah, no, it absolutely is, and that's really good perspective. And again, even when you look into the backyard of other teams like the Mariners, I can tell you conclusively that the Mariners are going to lose 11 straight games probably a month from now, and it's going to be fine. But that's a guarantee. I'll lock it in. I can't wait for people to tweet me that, oh, wow, Mariners lost again, and they're throwing just bullpen game after bullpen game already. But that's it. that things are going to get better. And 7-9, had you asked me at the beginning of the season, knowing that there were going to be those Yankees games, hey, the Jays are going to be 7-9 entering a couple, four games against the Rays and the Sox, which are the ones that are coming up. I would say, again, if you can split those games, if you can just be 500 in those games, that's a real win. That's a real win. Hyunjin Ryu, though, it's got to be asked. Must-win game for next start? Are you declaring it? Or do you have to feel it in the moment? Do you have to feel it in the moment? Okay.
Again, it's a... To have three must-win games in the first 16 games of the season, it feels
like a lot.
Hyunjin
Ryu against the Red Sox kind of feels like a must-win game to me, I got to say. It does. It feels like a must-win. It just feels like one. It feels like one, you got to admit. It feels like it.
I would say I'm leaning in that direction, but I have not yet.
I'll let you feel it. I didn't mean to pressure you. I don't know. I know your process is one that you don't like to be influenced one way or another. And actually, you're the type where now that I've brought it up, you're probably going to push back and say it's the Mets game the following day or whatever. But that's the way I'm feeling it. We got to take a break. I got to say that optimism for the Blue Jays, I need to extend that to Zach Hyman because, he takes that knee yesterday. And, I just didn't need this weekend of sports, you know? Like, I just didn't need this to be... I needed sports because that was the conversation I had with friends, was thank God we have sports. Remember the first wave of the pandemic where it was you're inside, you're afraid, and you don't have sports. And we had to watch reruns of games. We watched the whole Raptors playoff run, which was actually really fun. But this is... a different story this weekend because, the Raptors are ruining the tank. They've won three straight, and no one's happy. Nobody's happy. Please,
Utah.
Raptors.
Utah's happy. He just signed a deal, but, other than him,
unbelievable that they've done this. It's like they've ruined the season twice. First team in NBA history to ruin a season twice. The Blue Jays, they trotted out a lineup that reminded me of 2017. Yeah. And then Zach Hyman takes a knee and it's to the surgically repaired one. We're going to do more with Justin Bourne at 10 o'clock for our full Leafs hour, but I almost turned the game off. I honestly was just so upset. I was watching on my laptop and my hand did the phantom like reach to close the laptop, and then my brain had to go, hey, this is your job. You have to watch this. I didn't want to, though. And hearing John Tavares after the game saying that Zach Hyman was optimistic and he was moving around, that's the kind of guy Zach Hyman would be to me.
Yes. Right. Well, he played three games with the torn ACL, MCL, whatever, three playoff games.
Yeah. I would just say that even if Hyman is back in the lineup a week from now, my terrified index would still be very high because he's the kind of guy who's going to play through an injury. And I can already see the story of the Leafs losing and then the day after they get bounced from the playoffs, it's announced that Zach Hyman needs surgery. Anyway, well, I'm not going to get ahead of myself with that because I've had my fake doctor's license stripped. But I have to feel optimistic about Zach Hyman, but we will keep you updated throughout the day if we hear anything.
Yeah, here's what you can be optimistic about, and here's what made you feel good, I imagine, over the weekend.
Let's do it.
F1. We have dropped in at the perfect time, it seems, into this sport because we have a real rivalry. We'll talk about our F1 takeaways coming up after the break. It's a good show. Ben Ennis, JD Bunkus, Sportsnet 590, The Fan. All right, Justin Bourne joins us, as he always does, Monday morning for our Leafs Hour on Good Show and Sportsnet 590, The Fan. Ben Ennis, JD Bunkus, and we just got the news, Bourne-y, that Alex Edler has a hearing with the league, and apologies to Kevin Bieksa, but I think that was pretty filthy looking knee on Zach Hyman.
I'm glad to see he does have a hearing for that. Kevin Bieksa talked about that at intermission after that. I thought he made some interesting points about how, you never really intend to give a guy a knee-on-knee hit, even the dirty plays. It's sort of like an instinctual, just try to get a piece of this guy type of thing. But it doesn't matter. It doesn't matter what the intent was. It's such a bad play. The NHL has done a pretty good job of penalizing it swiftly and severely. But that one was worst case scenario. I think Edler was at the end of like a 2.5 minute shift or something.
3 minutes, yeah.
3 minutes, which probably didn't help. But yeah, man, bad play. Really bad.
Yeah, it was a bad play. And you're responsible for your actions. There's no doubt about it. But I do think that BX's points were clear and were very good, which is, yeah, that's a reactionary instinctual play. So I have zero problems with that. Like, two things can be true, and it was a dirty play. It's one that deserves a suspension or at least a fine. And two is that I don't believe that Alex Edler is sticking out his leg thinking, oh, I'm going to knee him. Like, yeah, right. I don't think that that's happening. Obviously, that's not happening. There's two big things here, though, now. One is it's Hyman's surgically repaired knee, which automatically makes us assume that it could be worst-case scenario, which is possible. They've said that they're optimistic or that he's optimistic, and whatever that's worth, I'm holding on to it because it's the big question of the day is if he is out or if he's not even able to be at 100%, can the Leafs win? And this is the question that I've been toying with all morning. Can the Leafs win if Zach Hyman is either not in the lineup or not himself?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, we've had this conversation a number of times where, you know, we are all established Hyman lovers. That's a thing, and that's great.
Who is?
But the power rankings of where Hyman is in terms of importance to this team is like, you know, when the three of us have this conversation, it's scary high. Like,
oh, yeah.
I mean, I think we've said it's like Matthews, Marner, Hyman. You know, it's just looking this morning, even at the raw stats, it's like in about the same number of games, he has as many points as Willie Nylander and more goals. It's like not to mention everything else he does in terms of penalty killing and last minute protecting leads. So, yeah, I read something. Jonas Siegel does something in The Athletic on Monday mornings just about how, looking at, what Nick Foligno can do and kind of plug into that Hyman spot. It's like, get out of here. I don't want to see that. Like, you know, there's no replacing that guy. And he mentioned that as much, too. But it's just like, I really want to see this team fully formed. And I think that's been an issue in the past few years. Like, it was always like, when this team has everyone, they sure will look good. I sure would have liked to get a couple of games where they had everyone.
Well, especially considering that, obviously, the reason why you go out and add Nick Foligno is that you're trying to make your team better, but also that it gives you the potential of having a top six where both lines have a guy that loves to go in, loves to be a forechecker, will battle in front of the net, and will do all of the dirty things. And now if that doesn't happen, all of a sudden your lineup flexibility changes so drastically, right? Not only do you not have that power top line option of going with the Hyman, Matthews, Marner look, but you are searching for a third line again, where you say, if Hyman drops down, you feel as though all of a sudden Mikheyev is a different player, right? All of a sudden, the potential to have Kerfoot there is a different player. All of a sudden, the Riley Nash. I don't know if Engvall's going to be there come playoff time. That's why I'm not mentioning him. But Engvall's been a better player with Hyman. That's the good thing about Hyman is that he's the fixer. He's the guy that goes up and down your lineup and fits wherever you need him. So removing that puzzle piece is awful. But I am having trouble being that mad at Edler because this is so much process result. Like, that's a reactionary play. A game before that, and I actually thought this went really under the radar, Zach Hyman, just about, who was it on the Jets that he almost chopped in the face with his stick? Like, if that stick is a little bit closer, it actually makes contact with a face, then we're not even worried about the Zach Hyman injury because Zach Hyman is serving a lengthy suspension that goes into, God, I don't know how long. That was like a Chris Simon play. So a lot of times these things are a bit reactionary. A lot of times you lose your head for a quick second and it results in an awful play, which again, you deserve to be accountable for. But I'm not going to blame Alex Edler to the extent that I think some Leaf fans will. But I'm terrified. I got to say, I'm terrified about losing Zach Hyman. I think that the Leafs need him to win. And yeah, if I am looking at this of players of most critical importance right now that you could not lose, it would be probably Matthews, Marner, Muzzin, Tavares, and then Hyman. But the fact that he's one of your best five players, you just can't lose that if you're trying to win.
Well, and what's wild too is, this guy, you mentioned it was it's a surgically repaired knee, and we have talked all season long about the cost of Zach Hyman, what he's doing to his next contract. It's like, if this guy's had a banged up knee and if it's, hurt again, how much term do you want to give to a guy if you don't know what you're going to be able to get out of him? You know, you hate for injury to hurt a guy's pocketbook, but, like, if I'm the Leafs and it's the same knee and the same issue, the term I'm willing to go on the next deal is different. I am not going 6 years on a guy if I'm not sure he's going to be hobbling around for any portion of that, and that sucks, but, like, man, just the nature of the business.
Yeah, you know, but it's not a Jake Gardner situation where, I mean, Jake was obviously a lot longer in the tooth when the back issues started showing up, and he was never the same guy after leaving the Maple Leafs. But yeah, you hope for his sake that that's not the case. We're putting the cart, I guess, way ahead of the horse.
Yeah.
Although, when you talk about a guy who played 3 playoff games on a destroyed knee, the fact that he didn't immediately get up off the ice, probably not a great indication.
No, they said he was optimistic in the dressing room, and I know this sounds like, I'll believe anything, but I kind of think that matters.
I do too.
I know if my knee was shredded the second time, there's no positivity coming out of my mouth.
No. And the only pushback I would have to that, and I don't really mean to do that because I'm trying to stay optimistic about it too, because it would just be the worst thing. I can't. It just would be so awful if the Leafs got to this point, they push the chips in, and then they lose one of their top 5 players heading into this playoff run, or he's compromised. But if Zach Hyman is the leader, which I believe him to be, then trying to keep the room light and trying to be optimistic and not being a sourpuss about it would kind of fit the MO of that player. And the wait-and-see approach, that would be the one that you'd want to have, that everybody would be trying to keep spirits high because of the season, because of the contract. Like, you got to remember, this guy is thinking, he has to be thinking about those things as well, right? His future, his contract, him trying to win a Stanley Cup, his impact on this team, where he is in the lineup, him being around his teammates, like, all of that has to be flashing through his head right now. So, yeah, it's bated breath that we're waiting for this thing. I don't know when the Leafs are going to address it, but the longer it goes on, the more my fear is going to uptick, because we do – well, here, we have the technology.
No, you
the
wanted
technology.
To skip in this morning, right?
What? Yeah, but that's it, is that we have
it. Skip into the dressing room.
I need it. I need to know that he's going to be okay. And this goes back to the same thing that I've been discussing all week, or last week when Ben was gone at the end of it. But it really does feel as though load management in this season is going to hit a little bit differently. My only pushback to the load management thing has been the Leafs haven't looked very good over the last couple of games. They obviously had a ton of chances yesterday, and Holtby got the best of them, but anytime you lose to a team that was hit with COVID that way and was off for as long as they do, it's really hard for me to just say, well, your expected goals was good. They still lost. They only put 2 behind Holtby. Do you guys have any concerns as to the nature of kind of saying our priority is rest and recovery when you're still kind of trying to establish habits and you still want to be going into the postseason or the last final stretch of the season hot or your best selves? It does feel like there's a diminishing importance to the wins, but maybe that does come at an added cost that we didn't factor in for a sport where normally you don't do that.
Yeah, it's a good question. It's funny, like, there's almost been, like, this assumption that they're going to win the division. It's like they're 3 points up, I think, on the Jets or something. Like, it's, or maybe 4. Like, it is not a, it's not a given by any stretch. You know, I really worry about the handful of games, maybe a half dozen games heading into the playoffs. Like, you'd like to see a healthy team. You'd like to see a fairly stable roster or stable lineup in terms of, like, who's going to play with who. So I'm still kind of okay with them trying things out, mixing things around, resting people if they can. Like, the switching of the D pairs for last night's game was by all means just an experiment. Just
exactly.
Osborne.
He made his good point.
You were an experiment.
Good one. Here's my thought on it. I need there to be doubters. I need this to be a situation where they go into the playoffs not like they have at their best, not coming off the 3 wins in Edmonton where they allowed 1 goal and totally shut down McDavid and Draisaitl. I need this. Like, that's a bizarre feeling to have just complete faith in a Toronto Maple Leafs team going into the playoffs, and then when they get out-goaltended in Game 1 and they go down 1-0 in the series, then you have your freakout. No, be on edge. Have everybody on edge, the players included, but us as observers, fans, everybody. You don't want a sense of complacency. But that being said, I do think the resting of the older players especially is still important, and I don't know how much you actually lose from the roster by taking Joe Thornton out of it every once in a while. And obviously Jason Spezza has already signed up for the idea of not playing back-to-backs. Wayne Simmonds, throw him in there. Austin Matthews already put his hand up again and said, hey, the wrist felt a little bit wonky. Give me a day off and I'll be back and ready to go. I have already made my assessment of this team before adding the perfect guy at the deadline that they're the best team in the North Division. I've seen enough. I'd seen them play the other teams. I'd seen it on paper. Nothing's going to change my opinion about that. There's only one thing that will derail them, not from winning a Stanley Cup, because I do think without Zach Hyman, it totally changes their odds of winning a Stanley Cup. But there's only one thing that will derail them from getting out of the North Division in two rounds, and it's their own goaltending. Outside of that, they're the best team in this division.
Yeah, they're the best team. Resting guys is important. I like the idea of resting Spezza. I like the idea of resting Matthews. I want them to be healthy over everything else. My position has not changed in that. They should be looking at load management with these players down the stretch, and they should be trying to get guys as healthy as possible. That being said, the only thing that feels a little overlooked is that when there's already a lot of complacency down a stretch drive, that it's only human nature to look around the roster and say, well, Matthews is getting a rest day today. Well, Spezza is getting a rest day today. That maybe the guys who are getting the spots lower down the lineup care a little bit more. Maybe a guy like Nick Robertson feels as though it's a really, really important, I don't want to say debut for him, but an audition for him. But that for some of the other guys, there's a bit of a thought where it permeates through that the game is not as important because you have these built-in excuses of you're not having Matthews in the lineup. You're not, say, having Muzzin gets a rest day down the stretch. This year has been all about building new habits and proving that you are a different Toronto Maple Leafs team. Defensively, they have been that. The power play has shown, in by my estimation, that they still have some problems when it comes to mental hurdles. These reps, if they still matter for the power play, that means when you're removing certain guys who play on those units, you're removing those opportunities to get back to normal. So my only point here is that this isn't a vacuum where rest is a perfect solution. To me, this is not basketball. This is not the NBA where I know if I take LeBron James out of the lineup for a night, that if I put him back in the following one, that it's still going to be LeBron James and the Lakers. That the Maple Leafs are still a team that despite a very, very good regular season and one where they checked a lot of boxes and one where there's still more optimism if Hyman can come back and if Foligno is a part of this team, it's simply that the sport doesn't have maybe, is not built the same way for rest days as the way that other sports are.
But what are we talking about here? Because I really don't think there was ever a scenario and still isn't a scenario where they rest the top guys that aren't Matthews, that aren't dealing with something. Right, like I don't ever think that if John Tavares is fully healthy, to say, "Hey, John, we're going to take you to the lineup for a couple of games." I don't, for a night.
Here or there, not playing guys in back to backs. Dude, look at what just happened. What's more impactful right now, the power play or potentially losing Zach Hyman for the playoffs? These are the kind of conversations that they have to be having, where they go, "What we cannot afford right now are injuries. What we cannot afford right now is putting guys in precarious positions where they're playing too much and we're gassing them out before the postseason." I don't necessarily believe that's what's happening. I just think of if Lourdes Gurriel Jr., if there's data that tells the Blue Jays that a beneficial rest day for him when he's got 3 games coming off or 3 days where he's got breaks already built into them, that it makes sense for him to rest. That I'm guessing there is data to suggest that hockey players shouldn't be playing in back-to-backs after they've already put down 46-plus games of regular season hockey. That's all. So there's got to be these points where they're having these discussions that we're having right now where they go, what is the value of sitting Tavares tonight? What is the value of mitigating some of the risk? And versus making sure that you have a guy who can eat 20 minutes for you, not adding to the stress of other players, and also hurting some of those repetitions that you're going to need with, say, a guy like Nick Foligno, who you have to work in the lineup. It's a bit of a tricky stretch for this team all of a sudden, where they're trying to balance a lot of different priorities.
There's only one back-to-back remaining during the regular season. There's 11 games too, right? So the idea of protecting players from injuries, if there was a perfect wave your magic wand, if you could just rest everybody, you play the Marlies for the next 11 games, Leafs are still in the playoffs, and even if they're fourth of the four teams and everybody is at their best and you know that they're going to look at their best in the playoffs, I would say let's do that. But that's clearly never going to be the case. I think what you're going to see is the same thing with Spezza and Thornton. I think the other thing that you're talking about in evaluating this team in the final 11 games is the bottom end of this roster and having guys kind of trying out for those roles and whether they're going to be a factor when the playoffs get underway in May here, seeing whether a Nick Robertson can give you something, even if it's not to start the playoffs. If you get an injury, can he factor into the top six?
I think those things are important.
I think those are important. I also think that while it's not everything, that you are going to have a level of intensity, especially with these two Winnipeg games coming up, right? Because that's not nothing, and Winnipeg certainly thinks it's important to win those two games and be atop the division. I think you're going to see their attempted best lineup, especially when those are probably Nick Foligno's first two games as a Maple Leaf.
Well, yeah, you're going to see their best lineup. They're clearly not resting guys. I also don't believe the pressure on the Jets is nearly what it is on the Leafs. Not only from just a media and fan standpoint, but from a team standpoint in terms of what the expectation of the season is. The Leafs are going to have a lot of guys that are playing for this team not be here next year.
Yeah.
They're not. Joe Thornton doesn't have another year left in the tank. I don't know if Wayne Simmonds does, frankly.
Yeah.
They're probably not going to have Freddie Anderson. They are going to have to pay Zach Hyman, and they are going to be in a season where maybe Travis Dermott leaves, and they're going to have to ask themselves some very, very difficult questions about the future of Morgan Rielly with this core. It's a very, 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 very urgent season. You're right. I like seeing some of the guys down the lineup, but to me, the Robertson thing is more of a rep in case of an injury. It's more of a, hey, you've skated with the team so that if something happens, you can do this. But ideally, I don't think he's there. One, he's not... I don't think he's good enough to be there right now. If we get Bourne back at some point, I'll ask him a little bit more to elaborate on it and get his thoughts. But two, I believe that game one anyways, to start, they will do the we're giving veterans an opportunity. And that's going to extend beyond just the urgency of the season. That's going to extend to when you're trying to attract free agents to this market and you want to build your team this way, you can pick nits at whether or not the Leafs should be playing Thornton or Simmonds in the first round of the playoffs, and you can balance it with the urgency to win, whether or not it is the best lineup construction from a win probability model. But if your formula moving forward is that you need to be able to attract veteran players to cheap money contracts, part of that agreement has to be you're not going to sit them for a Nick Robertson heading or a Pierre Engvall heading into a playoff series when it might be your last, right? This is kind of the difficult dance that you have to balance. Again, it's all these balancing of priorities. This is what this stretch run is, balancing of priorities. Rest versus rest and recovery versus trying to win and habit forming, trying to build chemistry between lines versus trying to find out if different combinations can work. And lastly, whether or not you're resting veterans or pushing them forward and giving them added minutes and added responsibilities in a must-win season where you've sold them on being a part of a team that can win a Stanley Cup. It's a lot to juggle. That, like a week ago, I was looking at this thinking, man, what the hell are we going to talk about with the Leafs? What are we going to talk about? Because of all the things you said, they're the best team in the North Division when they're healthy and goaltending and blah, 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 and we'll get to that later too, but that's basically the Achilles heel or the way that it looks so far. That and the power play. You got to throw the power play in there now because we've come to the point where it's not just it's going to fix itself. It's now 11 games left, you said? I don't trust that they're going to fix it in 11 games. It looks so unbelievably bad that I actually think it's ahead of goaltending in terms of like the problem index. I really do. I really think it's a problem. At least we've seen the goaltenders play well, and Jack Campbell, whatever, he lets in a bad goal last night, I think in overtime, but it's always really, really hard to do the goalie judgment game on 3-on-3. The power play, they need that. Like, you've got to have that to win. There's maybe not going to be as many calls. You're not going to have this. But in these tight checking games where it's going to come down to the slightest of margins, if you're telling me the Leafs can't score on their power play and that they're momentum killers, that's going to bury them more than a potentially one bad goal here or there, that they can't recover from a bad goal.
Go back and look at the 2 7-game series against the Boston Bruins and how much of those two series were decided on special teams both way, both penalty killing and the ability to score on the power play. If you had better special teams in those two series, we might be viewing this core very differently in their successes in the postseason. You're right. Like, the only thing that's tough about the conversation is I don't know what they do, because they loaded it up again yesterday, and it's nothing seems to work with this team. Nothing seems to work with Bourne's technology. We'll try and rectify that issue and reconnect with him on the other side. It's Good Shows Leafs Hour. Ben Annis, J.D. Bunkus, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Many people today are having cellular telephone difficulties. It's a perfect time for that. Locked in your house, can't go outside, can't talk to anyone on your phone. That's good. It's great. Having a great day. Feeling really good.
A producer can't even text other people to
can't
get...
call them. No, he can't call them, can't text them.
Like, can't get out, can't go do a thing.
Yep.
Can't get people connected through their Wi-Fi. This is great. This is really good stuff.
It's really good. And people, not me, but people, were referencing the David Ayers game yesterday in reference to that loss. I'm glad you said that, because you called
that,
it embarrassing.
No, yes, if you do that, then you're dumb. I'm sorry, but I don't mean to do... I don't mean to enter your safe spaces and should have given trigger warnings. And maybe I'm just triggered because everything is falling apart with our show because of cell service interruptions, which, again, is like what's happening. But David Ayers is the most embarrassing thing that's ever happened in the history of hockey. There's never been anything more embarrassing than that. He was legitimately a shooter-tooter. He was someone where if you just got pucks on net, the Leafs were going to win. They were down a couple of goals, and they were minus a million favorites. That you jumped on it when it was still a plus number before the book got on it, and I've never been more jealous of a bet because it immediately froze and shifted over, right? It was one of the greatest bets of all time because it was a lock.
Emptied the
because it was a lock. It was a lock, it was a lock, it was a lock. And all the Leafs had to do was have effort, and they didn't have any effort. They couldn't gain the zone. They couldn't get shots. The few shots they put on David Ayers went in the net. It was truly a crisis moment for Maple Leaf fans, where you had built all these years to see this team built this way and perform like that, where everything went out the window when it came to how you build a hockey team and whether or not you can you can go get just skill on top of skill, and a pushback to things like heart mattering, something that had been basically mocked by internet hockey fans for the last 5 years. It all came to this point where you had to reevaluate everything. Last night's game was embarrassing in the sense of, oh, you should have won, and it's embarrassing that they get to have their win over you and get to celebrate over you. It wasn't embarrassing in terms of effort level. I think I saw a stat yesterday that they had more high danger chances than the rest of the teams in the NHL combined last night. They just basically peppered Holtby. They had a Spezza shot that goes inside the post and out in the most flukish of ways. They played a fine hockey game. There was nothing about them where they were dragging or they played very poorly against the Canucks. It was just embarrassing. No, it was just an embarrassing game in the sense of you don't want to lose that one. It wasn't guaranteed win night. It was an expected win. When you don't win those games, it stinks. Kudos to the Canucks, too. They deserve a lot of credit. And I looked at that line before the game and thought, I really should be betting the Canucks here because it was a little out of whack. I think the Leafs were something like minus 400 favorites in a hockey game, which
is the biggest underdog victory in the last 10 years of advanced stats and evaluating winning percentage probability. They were like 20-some-odd percent chance of winning in a hockey game in which the Buffalo Sabres occasionally win.
Right. I usually follow this philosophy when it comes to baseball gambling, where if I see a massive discrepancy between the two teams when it comes to the odds, I go, well, it's still baseball. This isn't the NBA. I'm not going to bet the other side necessarily in basketball, where I know that the tanking Orlando Magic are playing the Milwaukee Bucks. I'll probably just stay away from betting the dog in that one. But when it comes to hockey, yeah, who couldn't see a game like that happening? And, dude, Braden Holtby, that guy deserves a ton of credit for that win. He was spectacular. He's a vet. They brought him in there to be that kind of a presence. He battled all night, and I thought that him giving them a chance, him playing the way that he did, inspired the rest of the team to give the effort that they did down the stretch and be able to find their second win and play that way. And this gets us to the part of the show that we've been doing what feels like every Monday for the entire season, which is, are the Leafs going to get that? Are the Leafs going to get a performance like that when they need it? When the Leafs need a goaltender to battle and to be their best player for a couple of periods while they try and find themselves in a meaningful game, are they going to be able to find it? Let's just start with this. If you had a Jack Campbell rating, confidence rating, out of 10, what do you think the highest it was, and where do you think it's at right now?
Oh, the highest, it was at a 10.
No,
who couldn't
come
have been
on.
More
you
confident?
Had a 10, you thought... So you would have said going into the playoffs, Jack Campbell would have been a 10 for you. Come on, think about this question for more than a second. What was your highest rating of Jack Campbell? Yeah?
He was undefeated with a save percentage of like 940.
And you still had a 10, though, in a small sample of a goaltender that has been historically a backup.
Well, in his... Okay. I guess a 10 is too much. Like, I overdid it? Like, okay, see, that's not what
okay,
you want. 9.
No, you can... Okay, mine was not that high. I would have said that the highest I've ever felt was about a 7.58.
Okay, no, I was as high as you could possibly be, especially when... Yes, you're right. He had never been a prolonged starter throughout his career, but the career numbers, save percentage-wise, were good. And he's always been derailed by injuries.
There a 10 moments, if you go though, into the playoffs with Connor Hellebuck or Carey Price in his prime. Like... That you got to think about this as you have a goaltender that you trust with all. He's the best player on your team as a 10. I should have maybe explained these ratings to you. I thought it was kind of a simple game, but you convoluted it.
We always do this with numbers that meaningless numbers.
No,
like,
this isn't a meaningless number. If you're going into the playoffs tomorrow and you had to rank the units, right? So out of 10, your confidence out of 10 in the power play.
You asked me what my confidence was in the goaltending at the time. In the time, it was a 10. Okay, but you're talking about going into the playoffs. Reframe the question.
At the very peak of where Jack Campbell was, had you started the playoffs the next day, you would have said 10?
No, that's different. That's different. Okay. Going into the playoffs is a totally unknown, considering the guy
now
has
we're both
zero.
Cranky because everything has changed on the show. Everything is falling apart, and so now it's cranky. It's the cranky talk.
To clarify your question, no, it was 10 in that regular season game where he won 11 in a row. It was 10. I had 100% confidence in Jack Campbell in those regular season games in which he just did, no pucks got past him. And for whatever reason, he had the magic attached to him. Now, well, okay, if it was a playoff game, if we were talking about him playing, like, after win number 11, they were starting game one of a postseason series, you're right, it would be probably a 7 or something, considering
seven
the unknowns.
7 to 8. Considering, you'd be feeling good, not great.
Mm-hmm. Now we're back to 5.
Yeah, we're back to 5. And, okay, so I have two quick things on Jack. Number one is, it's probably a little harsh right now, the judgment of his game. He's been playing a lot. He's been playing through an injury, and he's still mostly played well. He's still come up with a bunch of big saves. He has not been a terrible goalie through this stretch. I don't even think that he's killed them through the stretch. If you get 2 goals and the goalie lets in 3, it's really hard for me to look at it and say, well, you didn't really do your job. You let in 3 goals, including an overtime, to the Canucks. A lot of them very, very clean looks. Wasn't awful. We can say that he should have one of those, which I think is a fair criticism. So when we say, did Jack Campbell play well, we would say no. But he was okay, right? He wasn't bad. He was okay. It's the same thing that I wanted to have conversations when it came to Freddie Anderson with. So overreacting to a couple of games with Jack Campbell is definitely what's happening here, right?
Yes.
The next thing is, though, is it's kind of fair to overreact because of what you've said. This is the best Leafs team that they've ever assembled, and there's a lot of anxiety as to whether or not they're going to be undone by goaltending. And it's been a problem for them for over a year. It's been 2 years. It's been 2 years where you have to litigate and discuss and debate whether or not the goaltending is good enough. And finally, when there was this shred of optimism, when you thought, oh, okay, well, maybe they have such good goaltending that it's going to be a problem to figure out which guy it has to be, I would say that you're back to at least wanting to see Freddie Anderson in the regular season, that you really, really are hoping that he can show you something, because this is kind of the Jack Campbell story, just a little bit anyways, which is that it's largely unproven and you don't know what you're getting. Three, this is going to be the unfair part to Jack Campbell, so brace yourselves. Jack Campbell is the quote-unquote good guy. He's the happy guy. He's the guy that everybody loves because he's the team puppy. I'm sure that the only reason Jack Campbell got to the NHL is because he is a badass competitor who cares infinitely about winning games. You and I have talked about this in the past, that I'm sure a lot of this is genuine, but there's part of it that is also maybe not a facade, that's strong, but part of it that's a little amplified, right? For media, for teammates, whatever. We've all known people like this where when they're good guys, they amplify the good guy-ness. They lean into it. But watching him go through a little bit of a stretch where he has not been A1 and where this team has been losing, I think it's a fair thing to bring up whether or not when you're someone who rides the highs of highs and you're going through this winning streak and you're starting to believe that you could be a goaltender in the playoffs and that you could be the guy of the future and you're playing very well and it's coinciding with a lot of happiness and joy, that when things start to go south and things start to go a little bit poorly, you don't really have the reps to be able to deal with getting yourself out of that funk as easily as other guys. He was pretty good with the media yesterday, all things considered. Like, he wasn't down in the dumps Jack Campbell like he has been in the past.
Which is shocking.
Yeah. He said the thing about the guys deserve the 2 points, which was fine, and that Holtby outplayed him, which was also true. But he wasn't he didn't sound devastated, which I don't want him to sound. I want Jack Campbell to sound like, hey, I could have been better. He played better than me. I recognize that there's a bit I've got to do, but ultimately, I'm going to completely erase this and move forward. He's had a bit of a front-runner career as a Maple Leaf. This is the first little bit of adversity, and so now it's a different test for him. And this is what happens when you accumulate data about a guy. Can you bounce back from the losses? Can you carry yourself out of this? Can you be the one who elevates it without the Leafs having to put 5-6 goals past the other goaltender? Can you get back to that level? And if Jack Campbell plays a bunch of these games, if he plays these Winnipeg games, for example, where he is going to be asked to outplay the other goaltender or match the other goaltender, how will he respond to that? It's a big, big, big test for Jack Campbell. It's the biggest one that he's had so far as a Toronto Maple Leaf.
The best athletes in all sports, whether it be hockey, baseball, golf, whatever, when things go poorly for those athletes, feels like their demeanor never wavers. Mm-hmm. Like they have confidence for years and years, for forever and ever, and it doesn't matter what happens to them. It's a bad break, and I know my own abilities, and of course, like even the mere suggestion that things were going off the rails for that person, they would laugh you out of the room. Does that exist with Jack Campbell? Because I think it's a fair thing to wonder, considering how he feels like he has a lack of confidence when things are going poorly. Can you be a guy that basically fakes it? That fakes that you know it's going to go well? Can you instill that level of confidence in the rest of your teammates, even though you've never been there before? It's a great question, and one that we don't have answered. And it's the second biggest question or point of intrigue. It's really the most important thing we need to figure out this season, but it's the only other major sticking point that I'm really paying attention to in these final 11 games is goaltending. The other is where Nick Foligno fits in.
Oh, no. Well, to me, again, the power rankings of what you need to see down the stretch go one power play correcting itself and looking competent. Because I do believe this is where I'm at with the goaltending. It's not maybe going to be ideal, but it's going to be okay. I don't think Jack Campbell sucks. I don't think Freddie Anderson sucks. If you have those two guys to be able to switch back from, I do think you're going to get a baseline of competent goaltending, right?
If the Maple Leafs get the Freddie Anderson they've seen in the postseason now for four years, they win
the North Division. They're fine. Yeah, they're winning every single time. This is the weird thing about the Freddie Anderson story is that, of course, he's let in bad goals in the postseason. But guess what? The Leafs have had bad games. People act like the Leafs never had bad games and it was just Freddie Anderson that was letting in bad goals. No. Leafs didn't show up for Game 5 against Columbus last year. Freddie Anderson let in a bad one and everyone said, well, it's Freddie Anderson's fault. Where were all the goals they scored?
Right.
Did they score a lot of goals? No. Do we just forget about Game 6 against Boston where they have a chance to close out at home and Freddie Anderson plays brilliantly but the team takes a poo-poo in front of him? No, right. We don't talk about those games. We just talk about goals that went in because they're easier to remember. That's the whole thing. If the Leafs get the goaltending that they've gotten from Freddie Anderson the last couple of years, they get it in the first round against the Montreal Canadiens in front of this Maple Leafs team, they're going to win. So can it go up? Certainly can. If it's that, you feel great. I'm worried about the goaltending having some bad games against the Jets and maybe being their undoing and having bad goaltending or having goaltenders that are not healthy. But as of right now, it's right below the power play in terms of things that are important to me. Because again, the power play is supposed to be a weapon for these guys. If we're saying about resource allocation, the cap in this team, the roster construction is we have talent, we have skill. And when you have a player that's missing, we should be able to score at a rate that is higher than any team in the NHL outside of maybe Tampa Bay. That's the bar. What is the acceptable bar for this power play? 2. It's not even a top 5 power play. It should be number 2. And they're not that. They're 12th, I believe, as of today, right?
Whatever. They're not inside the top 10, that's for sure.
They're not inside the top 10. They've got to figure out the power play because it's the one thing that looks broken. The goaltending does not look broken. The power play looks broken. So that's one. The goaltending will always be 2. The third one, sneakily, and I really wanted to do this today, and I don't know, we're going to have Bourne on again at a different time this week when cell phones work again. Morgan Rielly has not played well. And frankly, I can't remember a guy who's played this poorly, who is of this importance, who gets this much hype, who has been sheltered the way that he has been sheltered from criticism. Like, you tell me that in a market where we hammered John Tavares for the first half of the season, hammered him, where William Nylander is a constant debate as to whether he can even play hockey, where we have crucified Freddie Anderson, a goaltender who has made, who has not only made all-star teams, has looked like one of the best goaltenders in the NHL for stretches. Where has the Morgan Rielly discussion been? They're shuffling up the D pairings. Why do you think they're shuffling it up? Why do you think that they're moving things around? I can tell you why. It's because one guy has been not living up to the bargain when it comes to the blue line. It's Morgan Rielly. There's been conversations about whether or not the power play should be shaken up and whether he should be the guy that's actually on that. Whether you go to 5 forwards, because I don't think they have another defenseman for it. Jake Muzzin doesn't look good on that unit either. But I truly cannot remember a player of this skill, this ability, this importance that has gone as under-discussed as Morgan Rielly has. Truly. Can you provide me with an example?
Especially a defenseman. Like, usually those guys get absolutely destroyed in the media and by the fans. Perhaps our next guest has some insight into this. Former Kings assistant GM Mike Fiuta is on the line right now. Doesn't have a telephone. How's it going, Mike?
I'm doing okay, guys. Sorry I missed your... prelude to who you were taking
apart. We're talking
about here.
Morgan Rielly. Morgan Rielly and his play this season in an overall sense, and that it has not been consistent. It's been very uneven, and that usually when you're a defenseman and that happens to you, you get ridden out of town, and it hasn't happened to him. He hasn't been abominable, but it has not been great.
Yeah, well, I'm glad he hasn't been ridden out of town. I do agree. I think for a kid that you know, they've kind of thrown the ball to be their number one. I don't think, I mean, a lot of NHL teams have guys that technically get the designate number one, but they're really not number one defensemen, like as opposed to like a Hedman's a pure number one, correct? You know, and yep. Just because you're the best defenseman on a unit doesn't mean you're necessarily a legitimate number one. And I thought that Morgan, based on his junior career and where he was trending with the Leafs, was trending towards closer to being a number one. It's just strange. He's been very inconsistent. And for me, the one thing I've never questioned about him until this year is some of his decisions. I've always thought he had very good hockey sense, and I've just seen some really strange reads. He's not a lazy hockey player by any stretch of the imagination. Like this guy, my coach Mike Stuthers had him in junior and said this is one of the most dedicated team guys, and you can tell his teammates love him as well. But some of his decisions without the puck, and defensively, and that's got to be his bread and butter, because there's really, I mean, I think that's why they brought in Tyson Barrie last year to get a legitimate power play guy, because I think Morgan isn't he's a good power play option, but he's not a great power play option. But I agree with you guys. He's not playing his best hockey right now, but I also think that if this team's going to have one of these ruts and slumps, this is the time to have it. I mean, I had talked about, you know, even Jack, you know, it was great that he was doing what he was doing for the team. I mean, I think it proves now more than ever how important Freddie being healthy is going to be for them to have a chance to go a long distance. But I'm more frustrated with Jack and his press conferences, to be perfectly honest with you. Hey. I mean, I love the fact that there's an accountability factor, and that's great, especially internally with your teammates when they know, like, it's easy. I think it's fine to stand up in front of your team in the dressing room and say, guys, whatever, I'm letting you down, I got to be better. But when you're constantly doing it on television, especially in a market like Toronto, I mean, even they're picking up, but it's now become a talking point on Hockey Night in Canada. Like, how down is he on himself? And I've told him personally, and I mean, I know, and because I just said, you don't need to do it, Jack. People know what you're all about. But when you start to do that constantly in the market like Toronto, especially then when every Leaf fan and hockey fan is watching this in the middle of a pandemic with, you know, bated breath, because this is the team that has to go the distance. You start to, instead of just saying, wow, that's accountability, you start to feel sorry for him. And is the mental toughness there to get through it? And I think it's just something he's got to work on, because he is a mentally tough kid. But those post-game press conferences are getting hard to watch. The same thing when he doesn't have a great game. I mean, you just got to put it beside you and move on to the next game.
Mike, we're just bozos who know nothing. But this is what we were just talking about. And it always feels good when somebody who's actually a hockey person comes on, and it's like when your eye test matches the numbers, where it feels really good. Because, yeah, this has been the discussion that we were having is, hey, has Jack Campbell's performances been that bad? No, he's had some not as great games. He's not winning 12 in a row, but I don't think that a reasonable person would look at this and say, Jack Campbell is killing them in hockey games right now. Jack Campbell is not giving them competitive outings. And yet he had a media conference the other day where it was almost like, is he going to be able to make it to his hotel or back to his condo? Is he going to be all right? Are we going to have to put him on a watch list? Like, he's dragging. And you just said it. You've had conversations with this guy about the way that he comports himself. But do you think that that is going to be a real hurdle for him moving forward, that we need to kind of have this test, or that he needs to check this box of, hey, Jack, you've got to prove that when things aren't going great, that you can dig out of this rut by yourself?
No, I think he's come a long way. And this was part of the issues with him, is just that mental challenging yourself. But again, I can't repeat, this is a real genuine kid. He means it. And I think he's trying, in his mind, when the team isn't playing great, he's trying to deflect from them, right? Like trying to deflect away from others. But in a market like Toronto, it just puts a spotlight clearly on you as, can I get through this? And I agree with you. It felt like the other night, it was like, are you okay? Like, you just won 11 games in a row and set an NHL or a Leaf record. Okay. There's going to be blips. Okay. Turn the page. And then again, there's nothing wrong with standing up in front of your teammates and giving that, vibe off, and then internally you guys can pick each other up. But when you're doing it at a press conference with the whole world watching, I think it can be read in a lot of different ways. I mean, the other night Kelly Rudy was basically throwing out an olive branch to him, you know, right. You know, you're going to be okay. Are you going to be okay? And that's just, you got to be, it's again, and I don't think it's a mental toughness because he knows what to do to reset, to be better. But if you send out that distress signal, that would concern me whether you're right, you know, what's it going to be like in a playoff game if you lose a playoff game? Like, what's that press conference going to be like? Like, just man up. Your team loves you. Just get through it. There's blips. Nobody's going to go 20-0, and nobody's never going to have a goal not sneak through your arm. Just like, but again, this whole Leaf thing is new for me because it's the first year I've been back and got to take it on where it's like everything is, and I've always seen it because my dad used to yell at the television constantly when I lived in Toronto, but it's I think it's because they see this team and what it's capable of doing, and I still think that Nick Foligno, he's not Superman, but I think he's going to bring a whole nother level of accountability. I'd be more concerned, and I'm sorry I didn't hear you guys, I usually listen, but I was not listening this morning and whether you guys addressed it. I mean, I don't know where the Hyman thing's at. That would concern me more than anything, is Hyman's status. Because this, as far as I've said it before, it's clear Matthews is this team's MVP because he's just that good. But if you're telling me who your most consistent player is, who's your coach's dream, and who translates to the playoffs every night, it's Hyman. So I certainly hope that, that is not something of consequence, that he can get through and get back healthy and ready to go.
I think you were the guest that said, if you want to learn the Leaf systems, you just watch Zach Hyman play.
And yeah, no, it's funny because Daryl Sutter used to say with us, if you want to pre-scout the Kings, just watch Trevor Lewis, because from a coaching standpoint, that's exactly the way I want our system to play. and you can find player and everybody has it. The thing I said about Hyman too was, it's not just like Babcock took a lot of heat, but because he played Hyman in every position, because he was his dream player too. And then you move on to the next guy, and it's the same guy who has won the coaches over with his accountability and his play away from the puck. So everybody on that team loves to play with Zach Hyman, and it wasn't pretty to watch. I would have liked to seen, and this is probably going to get me in a little bit of hot water, but when you're up by that many points in a playoff series, that's one of those things where I would have liked to seen a little bit more of a reaction from them with regards to, and again, this isn't a 1970s old school thing, but that's your most efficient player taking a blatant knee on knee. And there's part of me, especially when your power play is 0-for-1,000, it's not something that you have to say, "Ooh, hold up, we got a 5-minute power play coming up." I thought there should have been a little bit more of a reaction, other than just waiting to see if there's going to be a 5-minute major, because that was not good.
That's a really interesting perspective, actually. And I don't know if it was one that was shared widely by a lot of people, but probably because of the perspective of Zach Hyman, which is, this is a guy who can stick up for himself. But you're right. If we're looking at things that are supposed to be different about the Maple Leafs this year, it's that they're supposed to be tougher. And part of that extends to sticking up for teammates. And if those guys don't know that Zach Hyman's a star, then I don't know what to tell them. They do know that he's a star. They do know that he's one of their most important players. And yeah, not having that bite, not having that happen at some point in the game, right after you said it, I thought, yeah, that's actually very, very true. If that's Auston Matthews, we'd be crying for it. And
it was right in front of their, no offense, right. It wasn't one of those, you can see their verbal reaction because the entire team stands up. So there wasn't something that was out of, like, it was tucked away in a corner where you didn't get a view and you need to see a replay. And again, I'm not saying that one guy or there should have been a premeditated fight after, but I would have liked to see more reaction at the time on the ice, other than, you know, there is that sentiment, ooh, we got a 5-minute major coming up. Let's go to work. Like, in fairness, those are the little things that I look forward to see. I think if Wayne was on the ice, Sim or something, you know, he would have at least been in a scrum. There would have been some kind of scrum. And I know for sure if Foligno was on the ice, that Edler, he wouldn't have been concerned about the 5-minute major coming up. I get that stuff in the playoffs, but right now when you're trying to define yourself as a team and this new identity that you had, I just would have liked to seen a better reaction.
No, that's a great point. And Edler probably going to receive some supplemental discipline, if not today, sometime soon. Mike, thanks so much for doing this on short notice. Appreciate it.
My pleasure, guys. Stay safe.
All right, you too. There's Mike Fuda. When we come back... I can't golf. My last 9 holes were pretty good, and I parred 18, and who knows when I'll be able to golf next. And that makes no sense. We'll see if our next guest can help us make sense of it. Scott Pritchard, Executive Director of the Mackenzie Tour, Board Member for Sport Tourism Canada, joins us next. It's a good show. Ben Ennis, J.D. Bunkus, Sportsnet 590 The Fan. So there's 2 ways to look at this. Part 18, my last round on Friday. One is I went out on top. 2 is that it's just heating up. I'm ready to get back out there, and who knows when I'll be able to. I did sign the petition on change.org to reopen golf courses on Ontario. I don't know what that does, but I did it. It was retweeted and into my feed by our next guest. Scott Pritchard joins us, Executive Director of the Mackenzie Tour and Board Member for Sport Tourism Canada. Scott, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
My pleasure. Thanks for having me on, guys.
Why is this important? Because I love golf. I know you love golf. There's a lot of people listening to us that love golf as well. Why is this an important issue?
Well, you know, I think golf has proven to be one of the safest, if not the most safe, outdoor recreational activity during COVID. And facilities all across the country, Ontario in particular, have, you know, gone to great efforts to make and ensure that their facilities are safe. There's really been no outbreaks on record related to golf or golf facilities. And so I think it's left many Ontarians questioning why this decision was made and why at this time.
I know, and I know you know, the some of the safeguards that have been taken by golf courses, who, I mean, even if you left it alone, would be pretty safe. But there's been a lot of safeguards that have been instituted at the start of this pandemic that continue and are even greater now in now our second season of golf. Can you illuminate for some of the listeners who maybe aren't aware of what's happened at golf courses, what some of those things that these facilities have undergone to make them even safer than they originally were?
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, you know, the experience when you first roll up to the facility, right? They're sanitizing and I should start actually fresh here. Wait, you know, you come in and everything is staged completely different than what you would normally see. The carts are staged differently. They're sanitized on a frequent basis. The push carts are all sanitized. Even your check-in experience when you go into the clubhouse, or at least into the pro shop, because the clubhouses haven't been able to be open, it's all very safe and very clean. And golf courses want to do that. They're motivated to do that because they want to remain open. And, you know, I've heard of inspectors, coming to the golf courses to inspect them and make sure that they're adhering to the rules. And to date, I have not heard of any fines or facilities in Ontario, going against the rules, as it were. So, you know, all in all, I mean, and then you get on the golf course and there's no rakes and bunkers. You can't touch the flagsticks. They have a number of mechanisms all across, you know, different mechanisms at golf courses where when the ball goes in the hole, they have the, I forget exactly what they're called, but they're essentially like a pulley system that you pull the ball out of the hole in your hand, or your and or hands of players never touch any of the, elements around the golf course other than your own equipment. So again, they've gone to great efforts to make sure that people are safe, and it's I'm sure a number of them, if not all of them across Ontario, are frustrated by the decision.
Well, it's especially frustrating given that we know that it's already very, very difficult to transmit via surfaces anyways. So mm-hmm. being asked to go through a lot of these measures, to invest the money and the time and the care that it takes to do these things, and then also be told later that you're going to be shut down, it reminds me a lot of with the restaurant business having to buy a bunch of heaters and then being told, hey, actually, it doesn't matter that you've had to, while you are being pushed financially to invest in equipment that should be able to help you in the long run, that's going to be actually irrelevant. It's even worse. And we do this thing where just because your mind goes, well, golf is a wealthy sport, golf courses make a lot of money. We think about the fanciest and the nicest golf courses and them being very operational and having large, large cash flows, that when those kind of businesses are hit, we don't really think about them with the same empathy as a mom-and-pop store, but it is still a business, and this is still something where people have dedicated their lives to it. Do you have an understanding of like what you're hearing right now from golf courses, their employees, the people who work there, the people who make a living from these places, what this kind of impact is going to do?
Yeah, I mean, I think I'll take issue with the comment, and I don't know if you really believe that, with respect to the misnomer that golf is a wealthy person sport or an elitist sport. I mean, that's the furthest thing from the truth. And I think that actually plays into the reason why golf is shut, is because people do believe that. And so, the government doesn't want to be seen as catering to a certain segment of the population. Golf is extremely affordable. Toronto is a bit of a different market in terms of affordability and accessibility, but all throughout the province, golf is accessible. So, you know, in terms of the business side, certainly golf courses that were preparing to open, you know, they've brought on all these new staff members, gone through all the proper training that they need to adhere to the protocols. And now, you know, those people are going to be laid off. And it's extremely unfortunate. And, you know, it is similar to the restaurant business. It's like, you know, I was talking to a general manager at a golf course, and when I called him, like, hey, what are you doing? He's like, well, I'm actually just making sandwiches. I'm helping the chef out. Imagine, you know, all the sandwiches that they would have made in preparation for a sold out weekend. And, you know, where's all that food go? So it's, you know, it's, again, frustrating, unfortunate. And I think one thing, you know, needs to be said in that, one of the reasons that I signed that petition and you know, I kind of got involved on Twitter, just made a comment, which I don't normally do, but, you know, I saw Dr. Isaac Bogosh come in and basically say, like, I'm dumbfounded by this decision. And Bogosh is on the Science Table Advisory Committee, as are a number of other doctors that came out and said, we don't understand the restrictions on outdoor activity. And so that, to me, is like, on one side of the coin, the government saying we're following the science. Well, then why was this decision made? And I think where people are getting further infuriated is that we're just not getting the answers. And that people are sort of at a loss.
Yeah, I'm at a loss. And somebody must have given you the heads up of our lineup today, because we're actually going to talk to Dr. Bogosh after you later on in this program. And yeah, explore some of the same things that you're talking about. I was going to ask you about the long-term ramifications of golf courses and the financial viability of them. But as soon as they open up again, people are going to flood back there. And again, I say flood, but people are spaced out. It's all done in a very safe way.
Mm-hmm.
When I returned to the golf courses, when the golf courses opened a year ago and I'd been stuck driving my kids to the airport to watch the one airplane take off every hour because that's all we could do when the playgrounds were closed then, and it took longer for the playgrounds to open. And luckily they reversed that decision so we can go back to playgrounds. It was such a huge relief to do that. And so many people, I think, felt that same way. And it really felt like it was a moment where golf gained a little bit of popularity as a recreational sport. Scott, have you noticed that since the pandemic?
100%.
That maybe people that hadn't played golf before are picking up some golf clubs and going out and trying it?
Definitely. 100%. I mean, there were 20 million rounds of golf were played last year in Ontario. And, you know, I'm not sure what the stats are in a normal year, but certainly there's been a resurgence in golf. And in Golf Canada tracks, when you enter your scores, they had the highest number of scores entered in a given year last year. So, and manufacturers can't keep up with the demand. There's like literally the golf manufacturers don't have enough shafts or grips. And it's similar to bikes. You know, people are clamoring to do things outside based on your earlier point that the disease does not transmit, effectively outside. And so people feel safe out there. So, yeah, you know, I think the biggest question for golf is the number of people, new people that came into the game, or people that, you know, came back to the game, or people that played more than they normally do. what's that going to look like in a couple of years from now? And I think as an industry, we're all hopeful that we'll maintain those people and their interest in the game.
So we've seen the province be kind of wishy-washy, flip-floppy on some of these issues. I mentioned the playground thing, which reversed itself in a matter of hours. Maybe we should all refresh Doug Ford's Twitter feed to find out if even what I'm saying is now irrelevant. But are you hopeful that there will be a reversal of decision here?
I am. I think you have to be as a golfer. I think golfers naturally are optimistic in that regard. You know, it's not going to, it's only 40% chance of rain. It's not going to rain. So it's kind of that same mentality. So I think so. And I'm very hopeful that it does.
Yeah, me too. Yeah, that's not my experience being a golfer. I'm not very hopeful. I'm always kind of on the negative end of the spectrum, thinking that my next shot is going to be a horrible one, but that's why I'm bad. Scott, appreciate the time. Thanks for doing this.
Thanks,
Scott.
Appreciate it. Okay.
Take care, man.
See ya. Scott Pritchard, Executive Director of the Mackenzie Tour, which is PGA Tour Canada, board member of Sport Tourism Canada.
So the optimistic part of me says having these things taken away, it's going to create even more urgency for people to get back outside and do the things that they love, right? That when you tell people that they can't have something or that they can't do something, the natural reaction from most people is questioning that decision, pushing back against that. And that your thought on golf and creating a whole bunch of new fans and seeing an influx of people joining the sport because it was an activity people could do, I would guess that we have seen a lot of outdoor activities go through the roof. That for a culture that has been driven more and more inside, there's an excitement for being outdoors, an activity that is refreshing, right? You would agree with that? That more people are riding bikes, I bet. Like, we now have bike lanes throughout the city that more people... Okay, sorry, jump in here. You want to jump in?
No, I was going to say, the bike thing reminded me of exactly that moment. I think it was whenever the weather... We got a sliver of sunshine. And remember, last spring was brutal, brutal, brutal. It was, like, freezing cold basically all through April. But in May, there was, like, a sun. We could barely see it through the clouds. Mm-hmm. And everyone was on bikes, buying bikes. I remember anecdotally going to the store to look at bikes for my kid. You couldn't buy a bike, a bicycle. You could not buy them. They were sold out of bicycles. It was like people were ordering online and were waiting weeks and weeks and weeks to get a bike. You couldn't get one.
It's like exercise equipment. More and more people are exercising. More and more people are aware of their health. Not everyone, and I think that it's actually a little preachy and over the top sometimes where you say, well, you should be doing this, you should be doing it. It's like, okay, well, everyone's dealing with things differently. But still, we just know that physical activity is good for you and that finding ways to be active and outdoors is good for you. And so the point is just that there is real momentum, that one of the positives of the pandemic, and yes, there are positives, right? There are things that you have to take away from this and say, well, what has gotten better and what can we focus on? One of those things I really do hope that becomes a byproduct is that more people are politically conscious, that more people put a little bit more effort into being aware of their governments and the people that they elect and the passivity that a lot of Canadians have towards politics, that maybe there's a bit of a shift here after what has happened at all levels of government, because it isn't just one where it's been incompetence. There has been mass negligence everywhere through every political party. So you can say that this show is leaning one way or another. It's not. It's everyone.
No. Oh, yeah. I should add on to that I come into this with no definitive I have political leanings, but no party affiliation. And
neither do I.
No, I've voted for, I think, every party in federal and provincial elections.
Yeah, here's where I come at it. Same thing. Who is the smartest and who has the best platform? That's it. And so I hope people are more conscious. I hope people are putting in more of an effort. I hope people realize that the attitude that often centers Canadian politics of, well, it's just essentially the same person anyways, isn't as prevalent moving forward as it has been in the past, and at least through my adult life. The activity thing has been a boon. I know it because I live right near High Park, and I have seen the amount of people that are in there playing and being active every single day. The amount of people that gather there, and again, safely. I don't ever walk through that park and think, wow, this is reckless behavior from people, because again, we have brains and we have been told over and over and over again to listen to the medical and scientific community, and they have told us that these are the activities that we should be participating in. But the amount of cyclists through that park, the amount of people walking through that park, the amount of people that are participating in, like, I even posted on my Instagram story about a week ago, some guys doing weird kung fu activity of some kind. Just, but people being active and people engaging with one another and having a place where they can congregate and do something socially, but also good for your mental health and for your physical well-being, that we would discourage anything of this, that we would try and halt any of that kind of momentum. Horrifying. Truly, truly horrifying. My hope, though, is that this only makes it double down, that people being told that they can't will, that they will overcome that, and that the people who are told, hey, you're going to have your momentum disrupted, not only won't listen to those things, because I'm at, like, I just straight up, I'm not listening to a lot of the, I'm not listening. I'll just tell you right now, like, I'm not going to follow the guidelines that have been outset of you can only go outside for an essential service. I'm going to the park. I'm going to exercise. I'm still going to do the things that I want to do outdoors. That those things, I hope the momentum continues.
Mm-hmm. Well, and there seems to be even a political backlash here that maybe there's some things that can happen in the framework of actual legal politics, but not everything has to be that way. Like you said, and I don't need to repeat what you said, but I believe in a lot of the things that you did say. And in fact, before Doug Ford's little tweet, I went out, I walked my dog, and I wanted to go by the local park to see if there was tape put up, if there was anybody there. And there was a kid there. There was a father with his young child. And I gave him a nod and was like, yeah, thank you. Thank you, because
you guys felt like little criminals, right? Like, you're this little, yeah, it's bad, like, boys,
you know, when you're driving,
bad boys,
and you see somebody
bad
in this,
boys.
You see somebody driving the same car as you. You give him a little nod. Yeah, I gave him a knowing nod.
Bad boys.
So yeah.
Look at us, bad boys. Gonna go to the park.
Yeah.
Bad boy.
No,
alert.
I know. But there's been a lot that hasn't been backed up by science that I've participated in. I've been a good boy. I've obeyed the laws. I have followed along here, but the public trust has been eroded to such a degree, and there's so much evidence, science and medicine based, that what we're seeing is insanity, that you can act as an independent human being with your own brain. And if you need help, we'll talk to somebody who knows a lot more than us.
If you want to join our crime syndicate of people who go and walk in the park, we are taking applications. All right, our crime syndicate will go. This criminal enterprise of going to the park to exercise and work out.
But only if the doctor says so. We will talk to Dr. Isaac Bogosh, infectious disease physician and scientist, associate professor at the University of Toronto, next. He's going to tell us whether we should have the go-ahead or not. Good show continues. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Listen, this weekend I said we need more doctors on this radio program. I said there's not enough. There's just people acting like fake doctors. J.D. Bunk has had his fake doctor's license revoked a couple of weeks ago.
Mm.
So let's bring... he's still trying
practicing
to give fake...
in international waters, yeah.
But yeah, let's have a real doctor on to hopefully give us information that we can
you
use.
You decide who knows best and who knows more and who's more accomplished.
J.D. Bunkus, fake doctor, and even that, he is in court for malpractice, or Dr. Isaac Bogosh, infectious disease physician and scientist, associate professor at the University of Toronto, kind enough to join us online right now. Doctor, thanks for doing this. Appreciate it.
Yeah, no problem. Happy to chat.
I actually feel like Charlie Day in the show It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia, if you watch that show at all, where he's the fake lawyer trying to say that he knows bird law.
I haven't seen it, but yeah. I'm just, you know what? Whenever someone says that, I just say, okay, I'll add it to the list. And then, of course, they never go back and watch the list. But the list is going.
Yeah. Oh, man. Yeah, your Twitter feed has been a bastion of sanity for me, honestly. I'm like, where is the truth coming from? Like, we're doing all these things that are supposed to be for the greater public good, that are not backed by science or the medical community, and you're bringing out the facts. So just blanket statement, does outdoor activity put you at high risk of contracting the coronavirus?
No. Full stop. Yeah, it doesn't. Couple things. Number one, I just try to be honest and fair, right? I try to stay away from the politics. Just let's look at the data. Let's be fair. You know, sometimes there's 2 out of 10 problems that get amplified to 10 out of 10. Let's just keep them as 2 out of 10 problems. Sometimes there's 10 out of 10 problems that get swept under the rug and are being billed as 2 out of 10 problems. Let's call it how it is. So outdoors, you know, outdoors is about as safe as it gets. I always get hate mail when I say it's safe outdoors because people say that's not true. It's safer outdoors. And they're right. It is safer outdoors. Nothing's 100% safe. Nothing's 100% risk-free. But, like, you want to see where COVID-19 is being transmitted? I'll tell you where it isn't being transmitted: on a playground. Okay? Like, outdoor environments are about as safe as they get. It's just so rare to get COVID-19 outside. It can happen if someone, like, coughs in your face. But, like, you know, let's be normal, you know, be outside, spread 2 meters apart. If you're not 2 meters apart, put on a mask. It's as simple as that. You'll be fine.
I've seen articles written about this, doctor, and I think it's true. And it's hard when something is so unknown like COVID-19, but our assessment of risk, it feels like it's been distorted. The people don't understand that in everyday life there's inherent risk in everything we do, and people always use the argument about the driving in cars and how dangerous that is. I think that's the go-to example. But do you feel like our assessment of what is risky behavior has been altered in the last year and a half?
It sure has. And the other thing too is there's a for whatever you want to call it, a visibility bias. You can see people outside playing and you know, tisk tisk and shake your finger, but you don't see people in factories. You don't see people working in warehouses. You don't see essential workers in unsafe work environments. Like, if you want to really get this under control, go where the money is. 80% of the transmission is in 20% of the province, and the vast majority of this transmission is in indoor settings. And we know that there's communities that are disproportionately impacted, and of course essential workers that are disproportionately impacted by this virus, largely because of work environments and transmission in indoor settings. So true, while the risk getting COVID-19 outside playing golf or tennis or playing on the playground is not 0%, it's just teeny, 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 tiny. Like, why are we, it's a distraction. Like, why are we focusing on that? Let's just focus on the major, major issues and create safer work environments, protect essential workers through vaccination and other policies that ensure that they can isolate safely, you know, pour vaccines and resources into communities that are disproportionately impacted. It's for starters, it's the right and moral thing to do. And secondly, it just makes this problem go away faster for everybody so we can all move on with our lives.
So what's really frustrating is that listening to you, it's, well, who wouldn't listen to what you're saying? Because this isn't just being reason or this is an opinion. This is you being a doctor, a qualified person to make these assessments. And yet, once again, we're in this position where it doesn't seem as though politicians are listening. And so I know you said you didn't want to get political, but yeah, you are someone who has a big voice. And there are others like you who have been brought to the table to share their opinions. Why does this continue to be ignored? Why is it that in the face of people who know, the people that we trusted and were told from the outset of this, because that was the whole thing when this all happened, was people shouldn't be political. This is for the greater good. We need to trust our doctors. We need to trust our virologists. We need to listen to the science and follow the data. That, how are these governments getting so off course? Like, what is the level of communication with people like you?
So I think there's a few things. One is, I'm not going to pretend to to be the government or know how or why they make the decisions that they do. But it's clear that there's multiple channels of information that flow into senior decision makers, and they end up making policy based on that. Some of that, not all, but some of that is from, you know, the science table and doctors and you know, epidemiologists and whatnot. You know, some of it is probably through their constituents. Some of it is through probably lobbyists. There's probably, I think we have to be fair and say that there's multiple streams of information that they're getting information from. Having said that, like, you know, the science is pretty clear on how to get this under control. And, you know, we have seen, you know, for example, this weekend was really telling, right? For starters, we heard they were going to start policing public health. In the history of policing and in the history of public health, that has never worked. And they walked that back after some public outcry. Okay, I'm glad they walked that back. They also, you know, started closing outdoor safe places. And again, they partially walked that back, which was all the right thing to do. I think they could walk that back further, but they still at least listened to the outcry or perhaps the science. And you know, credit where credit's due. I wouldn't have made that mistake in the first place, but at least they listened, right? At least they listened and walked that back. It doesn't mean the job is done by any means. We still have to keep our foot on the gas. We still have to promote evidence-based and science-driven policy. Because if we do, it's just better for everybody. Like, we'll just get this sorted out faster. I don't know. I am oversimplifying it, but still, at the end of the day, it is kind of that simple.
Yeah. Yeah, it does seem that way. Talking to Dr. Isaac Bogosh, what are the negative human impacts to the restrictions we're seeing with outdoor activity?
Yeah, so, I mean, we know that you can't stay hermetically sealed in a Ziploc bag in your house for 2 years. That's just unrealistic. Even if you have the luxury of having a house that you can isolate in, and if you're not an essential worker and have the luxury of being able to stay at home, people have obviously physical and emotional needs, and we can safely meet those needs by running around outside. So, you know, by restricting outdoor activities, it just detracts further from mental and physical well-being. We know there's so much good that you can do outdoors from a physical and mental health standpoint for kids, for adults, for any age. And quite frankly, you know, there's so much COVID-19 in much of the country. Outdoors is like the safest place to be. You want people outside. That's where they're not getting COVID-19. Like, we should be moving as much outdoors as possible. And of course, if you can't separate by 2 meters, put on a mask. But like, I would move everything outside. It's just safer. And there's very little transmission there. It's not zero, but it's very, very, very little. So anything, businesses moved outdoors, schools, you know, leisure activities, just get people outside. You know, never in Canada would you say the weather's good, but it actually is. It's working in our favor.
Yeah.
So let's do it. It really is low-hanging fruit here.
Yeah, it is. Although it's going to snow on Wednesday.
You know, I'm from Alberta originally, and like the May 2 4 long weekend, everyone goes camping, and there's about a 50% chance of a blizzard.
Yeah.
We know, yeah, right? No, with that line, there's no bad weather, only bad clothing. Like,
no. Yeah. Yep. Oh, buddy. Yeah, man, if they reverse the decision and open the golf courses on Wednesday, I'd be out there. Yeah, playing in the snow. 100%.
Yeah.
Before we let you go, Doctor, they've lowered the restriction on the AstraZeneca vaccine to 40 and above. What would you tell someone if they had any reservations about taking that vaccine?
Oh, my God. Okay. So look around. Like, there's a lot of COVID-19. This is an Ontario show?
Yep.
Yes.
Okay. I mean, we go national, but yeah.
Okay. Okay. So look around where you are. Chances are, if you're listening in Canada, you know, it's not every day you're admitting adults to the pediatric intensive care unit because you run out of space. It's not every day you're setting up tents outside of the hospital to care for people because you've run out of space in the hospital. It's not every day you're helicoptering people 200 kilometers away to an ICU bed because you've run out of ICU beds in your city. You know, it's not every day you're calling in, you know, healthcare providers from other provinces to help with the all hands on deck approach. Like, it's safe to say this is an emergency. And here you have a vaccine that can truly save your life, that can truly protect your family and the community around you. And you just have to walk down the street to the pharmacy and get it. It's as simple as that. Like, got to be transparent and honest. Yep, there's a very small and not 0% chance of a blood clotting event. But, like, come on. Let's put risk in perspective here. 40 years and up, go down the street and get the vaccine. It's as simple as that. There's 1,400 pharmacies in Ontario that are administering this and a growing number of family docs. Easy peasy.
Doctor, this was so illuminating and so great. And thank you so much for doing this.
My pleasure. Have a great day, guys.
You too.
All right, you too. Dr. Isaac Bogosh, infectious disease physician, scientist, associate professor at the University of Toronto. What else do you need to hear?
Nothing.
That was, I know it's just reinforcing everything we already knew, but it's like, it is still even different hearing it from his mouth. Like that, it's like soothing, but it's also, again, frustrating.
Anyways, the crime syndicate will be gathering outdoors, and they will be outdoors in full force, because it's lunacy to think anything but I should listen to what that doctor has to say, who has dedicated his life to infectious diseases. I know we all like to read an article, and we like to get into our echo chambers and listen to the things that we want to hear, but yet again, here is someone who is qualified, who is not us, who is not providing opinions, who is providing facts. Mm-hmm. And if you have a brain, you would probably just do a simple calculation and say, wow, you know, maybe I should trust that person. I don't know.
Seems I know.
Pretty straightforward. It's low-hanging fruit, but it was low. That's the thing, is it's low-hanging fruit. It's even the dumbest among us, even the yous and the eyes of the world are like, oh, this seems pretty straightforward and simple enough. Okay. Mm-hmm. And I think that the thing you raised about risk and it being totally out of whack and his comments on it, that those are really, really important right now too, right? Is that, hey, should you stop playing disc golf because one guy broke his ankle playing it in the history of the entire sports? Like, it's possible. It's possible to break your ankle playing disc golf. But is it likely? Yeah. No. It's very, very unlikely. It's about a 1 in 10 million proposition. In fact, that's probably very, very close to the odds of doing it. And so should everyone stop playing disc golf because one guy broke his ankle? And that it is theoretically possible to accomplish that? No, but it is possible, right? Like, there is a chance it could happen. But again, we have...
Life is not... It is not a riskless endeavor. Life. No. Everything. And maybe that's too simple, and maybe that's, like, speaking to you like you're a child. But I think
that's a bad way of putting it, just because it's like, hey, listen, that's almost like excusing it as though there's risk, like you're taking other people's risks into your own hands, or you're being selfish in some way by going outside and participating in an activity. It's like, no. The risk is negligible. The risk is such that a doctor who wants to make sure that ICU beds are not full. Like, again, this person is saying it's not about a risk of, hey, you know, it's an acceptable, it's a tolerable risk. It's a negligible risk.
No, it's not a risk. Yeah, it's not a risk.
Yeah.
Unless somebody coughs in your face.
Yeah.
That would have the disease, and then you had your mouth open. That'd be bad. Don't want that. Mm-hmm.
Don't do that. We advocate. Good Show is the show that says do not. We want to involve. Good Show is the show of the crime syndicate of people that go outside. Yeah. We are doing that because it is essential to be outside. Yeah. It is essential to move around and to be active. But we are not the crime syndicate of coughing in people's faces publicly in the park. That is where we draw the line, sir. We draw the line at that, okay?
Warring factions, yeah. Mm-hmm. All right. Do you have a transition to the Raptors?
No, I think we take a quick 3-minute break, which we can do here, and then we just end the show later.
All right. Let's do that then. Good Show continues. Sportsnet 590 The Fan. Well, Masai did his part. Raptors didn't really do theirs. No Pascal Siakam. No Fred VanVleet. No OG Anunoby. No Kyle Lowry. Still a victory. And Sam Presti. You know what? Sam Presti was so mad at when Letters came up with that big game a couple of weeks ago and beat the Raptors. Well, now who's laughing now? So the Raptors have found themselves winners of 3 in a row. And currently in a position to play in a play-in game, because the Bulls actually added pieces at the deadline. Mm-hmm. Like, the Bulls are trying to make the play-in game. Mm-hmm. And it might not happen right now.
No. Who would have thought that the most fraudulent two All-Stars to ever All-Star in Zach LaVine and Nikola Vucevic would not equate to championships?
That's
who would have ever weird. Thought? How embarrassing is that, that you put those two guys together, you're trying to win, and you can't beat out the team that's playing Yuta Watanabe, Paul Watson, a rookie Malachi Flynn the entire game, and still
Watson
you're behind.
Paul Watson went 0-for-10. 0-for-10 from the field, including 0-for-6. Raptors still managed to shut down the Thunder at the end of that game. I think they went like 5 minutes scoreless and pull away with a Chris Boucher three to ice it.
No, Chris Boucher decided to do good Chris Boucher things at the worst possible time. Yeah, it's just I know there's a portion of the audience that wants the Raptors to get into the play-in game and enjoy seeing them do this and all of the above, but the organization has made its thoughts clear on the ceiling of this team this season and what the goals of the season are, and it is to rest players and to make sure that they get a better draft position and put young guys in positions where they can prove themselves. So, you know, they've taken a fine at this point. The NBA has fined the Raptors because of the way that they're resting
players.
And they've continued to do it. And they're doing it in the face of those fines, because what matters more is making sure that those guys finish the season healthy and that the Raptors play young guys and, frankly, ideally lose these games. You can really see the differences between Raptors and Leafs fans, because Leafs fans know if you're a Leafs and a Raptors fan, you're cheering for the tank because you've already done this. You've already lived in this reality. You've lived in the reality of what it's like to be a bad team all year that had no hope, and then J.S. Aubin or Martin Gerber shows up and wins you a bunch of games, and you miss the playoffs, and you end up with no high draft pick. And the crazy thing is that in the NBA, it's far more valuable to have top-end picks than in the NHL. Like, the NHL, you can end up with many, many years where there's guys that really don't have that significant of an impact. Dude, look at the New Jersey Devils. And we were like, wow, the New Jersey Devils has got Nico Hischier.
Wow,
they're going to be unstoppable. They got Hughes and Hischier, Double H, the Helly Hansen of hockey. They're going to win forever. They stink. The NBA, you can hit on somebody who actually transforms your franchise. And this year, once again, we will continue to reiterate the same point over and over and over again, but it's because it's worth doing. If you end up with a top five pick in this draft, you all of a sudden completely change the complexion of your franchise moving forward. The Raptors, the fans who want them to win, are the ones who were the Leafs fans who wanted them to get into the eighth place all those years, because they just felt as though, well, playoff reps matter. They do matter. Guess what? The Raptors won a championship with this core. The guys who are on the team right now won a championship. They've had playoff reps. Pascal Siakam getting into a postseason play-in game where he's got to face Zach LaVine and Nikolai Vucevic or the Indiana Pacers is not worth more than Cade Cunningham. I don't know why I have to continue to explain this to some people, but I do, so I just will. Losing is paramount. It's why they're trying to do it. Getting to look at your young players and your fringe players that you might want to re-sign or bring back or make a part of this team is more important than finding out whether or not Pascal Siakam can score 25 points in a meaningless game where half of the league has checked out and a good portion of it is tanking alongside the Raptors. One of the worst parts about this is that Washington has gotten hot at the right time, because again, Russell Westbrook, same thing. But Washington has won 4 straight and the Raptors still remain up on them in the standings. They can still drop down. They can still find a way. Hope is still right there. Oh, well, you can fall behind the Bulls and the Wizards. Really, realistically, now this is what is done. There is no hope of catching the Cleveland Cavaliers. The Cavs, the Magic, and the Pistons are 100% picking ahead of you, barring a lucky lottery ball, right? Same go with the Rockets and the Timberwolves. You're already outside the top five. Mm-hmm. The Thunder have lost 10 straight. That's probably gone too. That's 6. Can you stay under the Kings, the Bulls, and the Wizards? That's got to be the goal the rest of the way, is to hope that you're just there. Because, man, I can't overstate what a disaster it would be picking outside of the top 10. truly, what a disaster it would be to go through all of this pain of this Raptor season with so few moments of hope, and then to go into an offseason where potentially Kyle Lowry walks in free agency and you don't have a top 10 pick. My God.
I got a good news, bad news thing to tell you.
Yeah.
Good news and bad news. Mm-hmm. 14 games left in the regular season, which is insane. There's a month of basketball still left to be played, of Raptors basketball, which is tough on the eyes. It's going to be very difficult on the old peepers, but lots of time to lose. And secondarily, got Brooklyn twice. You've got Denver, you got Utah, you got both LA teams, and in fact, you've got the Clippers twice. You have Chicago, who's just trying to win. Like, there's not... there's no Thunders left, right? Like,
dude, no,
who's the team that's actively tanking outside of Cleveland?
They have, yeah, a Cavs game that is going to be the tank-off game, where you're basically putting that down as a win in pen for the Raptors. May 6th against the Wizards is the game of the year left. May 6th, circle your calendars. Because where will you be? I got to say, too, that... I have no problem rooting for a tank, and I got to tell you that it's been exhilarating watching some of these games in these fourth quarters where you're rooting against the Raptors, and but it's like you're rooting against them, but you're rooting for them, right? You're the parent who's like, it's okay to fail. You want to fail now. You don't want to go through high school as the coolest kid who never has a blip, and then you hit real life and you can't handle it, you know? I want you to have a fail, high school child. I want you to have a moment where you have a slip up or a breakup or a girl breaks your heart or you get a B on a test, like, you know, or your team loses the game. You don't put your kids in sports so that they win every single game, right? You try to teach them how to handle a loss. Losing. This is exactly how you overcome this. So watching these games and that Thunder game, that was of great interest to me. I make no apologies for being the sports fan that my culture has created me to be, which is the one who roots against my team for a tank. I thought it was fun. I genuinely enjoyed watching that Thunder game, texting you last night and being like, no, Chris Boucher, rooting against the threes going in, trying to cheer for Poku and Dort. Like, Poku. Yeah, like, that was
all
seven that was fun.
Foot, 130 pounds of Poku. He's killing it. Good.
Embrace the tank.
Well,
embrace the tank.
We are. You are, especially because, yeah, it's shocking how much attention you're still paying to this Raptors team and how much of your sporting energy is invested in watching them trying to lose. But again, Masai Ujiri is doing his part. There's nothing more he can do. Paul Watson Jr. is starting basketball games for this team right now, okay? What else can they possibly do? At that point, yes, obviously the players are going to play their best, but Masai... You can't fault him. The thing you can fault him for is why Kyle Lowry has to live through this. But outside of that, there's nothing you can fault about the decision-making.
I got to tell you. I don't want to keep going back here. And part of me believes that Kyle Lowry is now re-signing with the Raptors because the way they've handled this. Like, I just don't understand how... Like, I don't know how you don't take a second-round pick for Kyle Lowry if he ends up walking away. Like, it's a bad thing that happened here because you're not even... All the whole case of having fans to get an opportunity to watch Kyle Lowry play and see him go down the stretch. We're breaking at 55. Stop flashing me that we got to go.
No, I have two different clocks that say two different things, but go ahead.
Stop it. Let me run the show, all right? You obviously you don't have the level of competence to run this thing, all right? Just like leave it to the experts. This is you. Take a note from the government. The whole case was that you get to watch Kyle Lowry play, and you don't have to see him in another uniform, and maybe he re-signs and blah. You don't even get to watch Kyle Lowry play. They've rested him the entire stretch run. I don't know if he necessarily even wants to play at this point. What? I don't know. He would probably want to preserve his free agency and not put miles on the tires unnecessarily and make sure that he can maximize his free agent dollars and not be an injury risk. Like, he's got nothing to prove. But you don't even get to watch him. So the fans of at least you get to watch Kyle Lowry camp. Like, what have we seen? One? Have we seen two Kyle Lowry games since the deadline?
Yeah.
Has it been three?
Yeah. No, I think Grange had the right tweet on this. It was he was resting and then got so tired from the resting he needs more rest. So he got to rest. And then yeah. Got hurt.
That happens sometimes. Sometimes you fall asleep, you have a nap, and you wake up and you're even more tired. That's Kyle Lowry right now. Yeah.
Who hasn't been there?
Subscribe to the podcast. Sure.
Yeah, do that also, and then listen to us again tomorrow, because I'm pretty sure the show is over. But we'll see you tomorrow. Bye-bye.